Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling, brought to you by Zwift, where fun is fast. I'm Graham Wilgos. Brad, we're not on our usual setting in Bath today.
No, we're in Chiswick.
We're socially distanced in the in the Eurosport boardroom in Chiswick. How are you, first of all?
Good, thank you. Yeah, it's the weeks are flying by now, isn't it? E3 Gent-Wevelgem again. Next week, we've got the big one, isn't it?
Tour of Flanders.
It's good to be back, as I say. It's good to have it back on its new normal scheduling, which I think helps us all because we're so
institutionalised,
aren't we, over the years. And we've got a guest this week, Matt Stevens, former professional bike rider, teammate.
Indeed, brief teammate. We had breakfast together, didn't we, as teammates?
Sporting a goatee resembling Damon Hill, the Formula One driver.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for inviting me back, chaps. Yeah. It's lovely to be here. But Matt, I am sporting
on.
a goatee that I like to describe as a cross between a teenage pirate and a magician.
You've also brought with you, and I like to think that you reach for this in a sort of Pavlovian way. If you've got a microphone in your hand, your bag of Haribo.
No, these are actual residual snacks from Milan San Remo, because I bought three or four bags of Haribo from Milan San Remo. Now, the epic, because we were online.
Epic shift last week for you, yeah.
And we were chopsing so much, didn't eat any. So I end up blowing with about 70k to go. So I've used them for Gent-Wevelgem instead this week. Well, I didn't, because I was chatting too much then, so we've eaten them just before the podcast.
Gent-Wevelgem today for you, as you say. Call it for us on Eurosport. Brad, you've raced this one a few times.
I have, yeah.
Set the scene for us. Mix of cobbles, unpaved roads, the Hellingen.
Kilometre zero, straight roads, can be crosswinds from the start. Those typical Belgian roads where you've got concrete slabs, very large concrete slabs with a rut in the middle. Every one of them is uneven. They're like 4 meters by 4 meters, these kind of square concrete slabs. And there's, you know, if the road is obviously two ways, there's four. So one makes up one lane, and then every 4 meters you've got a rut before the next one, and next one. Either side of that, you've got a strip of cobbles, kind of a foot wide, 2 foot wide. And then a bike path, which is also concrete slabs. And it's panned across the road. You've got fans each side of the road, or normally in normal circumstances you have. And they call it the Belgian ravine. That sort of.
Then there's a big ditch, I like to call it. A big ditch.
Yeah, which we've seen a few of the women crash into it when we were watching the race. It's very unique, is it, Belgium? There's no other country like it for roads like that.
It's, let's put it this way, it's got its own certain charm. Yeah. I think, you know, for many of us racing in our early days and amateur days, it's where you kind of learn how to ride your bike properly. I think that's the place where, I mean, people might go to Spain, they might go to Italy, they might go to France, but generally get yourself a grounding in Belgium and you learn a lot, because the landscape, the topography, the roads, they're unique. And that's why we get such brilliant bike racing, don't we?
Yeah, and it heads out towards the coast, the Panna, Coxeda, Ostende, along the coast, and then back inland and down to sort of Ypres. And of course, the sort of only real climb of the day, you've got the Redberg, the Zwarteberg, and then obviously the Kemmel, which they do laps of, and then it's normally a 40-kilometre run. The descent of the Kemmel used to be on cobbles, and it used to be treacherous. It was crashes every year. I'm not too sure how many years ago they actually withdrew it from the race, didn't they? Because there was the crashes were horrendous, weren't they? Do you remember Jimmy Casper 1 year ago?
Yeah, we mentioned it on air, actually. I think he was, I can't remember who he was riding for, but he
Unibet.
Basically, Unibet, and he basically crashed and face planted on the cobbles, and it was a horrific crash. And there was a camera, actually, a fixed point at quite a low angle that caught it. And I've raced as an amateur on that descent as well, and it's probably one of the most scariest things I've done, because they basically, on the last lap of the race this year, the last few years, they got the steep side, so it's like a wall, and that's what you dropped off. And it's pretty dodgy, because you're carrying a lot of speed. And when you're cornering on a cobbled descent, the bike handles in a completely different way, because you might actually, if you try and corner like you would in the road, you just drift outward. So you've got to start cornering a lot earlier. There's a lot of different kind of dynamics to descending on cobbles. So to be honest, it was say a death trap. It was lethal down there. So they've rerouted it for the last decade, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah. So,
and when you're asked to do that sort of make those sort of manoeuvres again and again and again. I mean, it's 247 kilometres today. It's one of the most I'm going to say most attritional races outside the monuments on the calendar. I mean, that plays a part too, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's brutal. As that descent, particularly, you know, you've got bottles flying out of the cages and things, which tended to cause a lot of the accidents. And you know, they've made it for I think there was one too many. You could say that descent is part of the race and part and parcel of racing in Belgium. But I think with the injuries that were sustained, I think it just became too much. But it's an extremely tough for a race that's flat with not too many hills on it. I would say it's not a war of attrition like the Tour of Flanders. But it's a race that from kilometre zero, you've got to be on the ball. And it's, I think, my best year, I think I may have been 21st or something. I made the front echelon at the start. I had a crash. I crashed straight over Matt Heyman at some point. And Edvald Boasenhagen won it that year. And it was back then. It used to be on a Wednesday. And it was the big sort of warm-up to, it was in between Flanders and Roubaix. And it was always the big warm-up to Roubaix at the weekend. But now, obviously, the calendar's changed a bit, and it's now on a weekend. But I felt like it took a bit away from the classic Gent Wevelgem, what it was being on a Sunday. I was like that sort of midweek Wednesday kind of hit out for Roubaix, where you didn't see a lot of the stars because of that, because a lot of them would take it easy. But it was nice if you hadn't performed at Flanders on the weekend, you had a chance to kind of, you know, top your distance up, or likewise, if you were a bit tired, you could back off a bit on that race. But yeah, my first one was 2002, first year professional, and Cipollini was world champion that year. And that was the year he, of course, got dropped on the Kemmelberg and missed the front when Hincapie won it. And he threw the bottle at the cameraman in between the races, yeah.
This wasn't the race where you rode up to the front group and rode next to Cipollini.
I rode to the front of the peloton. I thought I had my teammates on my wheel. We had Jackie Duran, Guédon, Mongin, and they let my wheel go, and I hadn't looked round and seen it. So I was just trying to go up to the right-hand side of the road as Acquasoponi were on the left with Cipollini. And lo and behold, I was on my own because they'd let the wheel go. So I just looked like a bit of an idiot. And Cipollini looked across, resplendent in his white world champs kit, top to toe, and sort of looked at me. He thought I was French. I spoke to him about this since, actually, and he sort of went, "Che cazzo francese," which is, you know, like, what the hell are you doing? You know, like, and yeah, that was kind of...
He won it that year. He won it in 2002.
This would have been 2003 then, sorry. Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
While he was world champion, but not... Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, 2003 then, yeah. No, sorry. It was 2000. It was 2002. It was... he wasn't world champion that year.
He won that day.
Because 2003, I pulled out the feed because I'd been up there in Flanders on the Sunday. You know, he definitely put me in my place that day. But, I mean, he was, like I said last week, the story of the Milan San Remo when he changed his kit 80k to go. There's no one else that could do that now.
No. He was a proper... I know.
Did you ever race with him?
I did. I raced quite a few races in Italy with him. And when I crashed in the Giro, actually, without going on about that, the following day, I was bandaged up, and he came alongside me just when the bunch was bowling along, and he just asked me if I was okay. He said, I think we spoke in French.
Yeah, he's good.
Because his English wasn't great then, and so we spoke in French, and he gave me a bit of a hug and said, "Hey, you okay?" And he said, "I saw your crash." He said, "I nearly came off as well. I just wanted to say, you know, well done for riding, and hey, good luck for the rest of the race." And I was just some like kind of just low-ranking rider, you know, and he's one of my heroes. And he can come across as very, very brash, but he didn't need to do that. And that showed another side to him that people might not often talk about. I always remember that. It was kind of just a nice touch. And he just kind of gave me a nod and then rode off. It was a really nice little moment.
Yeah, a bit like you were saying last week, Brad, with Armstrong patting you on the back at San Remo.
Yeah,
it felt like $1 million.
Well, yeah, you know, like, I think me and Matt were in the same boat, if you like. We kind of grew up fans of the sport and also part of a club system in the UK where you never imagined, you know, British riders very rarely went onto that stage. You know, a few did, obviously, but nothing like today. And so you only ever really, before social media and Eurosport's coverage and that, these are the people you only ever saw on the telly or in Cycling Weekly and magazines. So it was kind of, you were slightly in awe of them, starstruck, when you were with them suddenly in a race. And that must have been like that for you when you went to...
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you went from riding Premier Calendars to the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, those guys.
Well, Pantani and riding with the kind of, I mean, they really were icons. And I think Brad put that really eloquently, actually. There was a, it was a proper stardom about them. I mean, riders have still got that now, but there's a lot of different kind of ways to kind of interact with them these days. And although there's still a lot of greats of the sport, back then they were almost like kind of superheroes. And then to suddenly find yourself in the same bunch, breathing the same air, riding the same races, suffering maybe a little bit more than they did. It was something pretty special.
It was like the Pro Tour when Ekimov and those guys used to come and ride the Pro Tour.
Yeah.
You know, it was all the Kellogg's Tour, and, you know, it was quite something for them to come and race in your country and staying in travel-ins or premier travel-ins and stuff around the country and walking through reception and seeing, you know, Vladislav Ekimov walk towards you, or George Hincapie, or...
George Hincapie in a premier inn.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, and going down to breakfast and talking to the waitresses and stuff, you know, with like asking for, you know, rice milk when there's like, you know, British whole milk there with your Kellogg's cornflakes. And, you know, it's a very, it's a strange thing, but we're so used to it now. We're so used to it.
And just bring that Cipollini story back around for us again. So you've spoken to him about it since going to the front of the peloton and him saying to
you. So I had dinner with him a few years ago at Francesco Moser's vineyard. We were there, Daniel Oss, Moser, Fondriest. Cipollini was there because they're all up from that, you know, kind of... Cipollini was going skiing up in the Dolomites, so we were in Trento. And it was Cipollini, I was saying, you won't remember in French, was saying, because Moser speaks French. He said he didn't remember it, but I explained that story to him. And he said, I just thought you were French. And I would still speak to the French like that. They didn't like the French riders, you know. So it's quite funny, really. It's how times are changing, how international the peloton is now. Back then, like I said about the Giro and San Remo and Tirreno, when you were in the French team, they were Italian races. 80% of the field was made up of Italian riders. And you would get wild cards and come in as a French team. So at the Giro in 2003, my first one, you know, we had Francis Dujour and I think Bonjour at that time, or Brioche La Boulangère, were the only two sort of French teams invited to that race. And the rest of the race was Italian. So, you know, it's not like you have a whole mix of things. And Tirreno was the same, San Remo. They were all Italian riders. And it was their race, and you were in their world, and you were a guest, and you had to do what they said. And you didn't put, you know, foot out of place, because they would come down on you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, I think the Grand Tours back in that era, like the 90s and the early noughties, were quite parochial. You know, the Tour was the same, the Vuelta was the same. You wouldn't believe it, but there'd just be a few kind of guest international teams rather than the Vuelta, because back then, both Italy and Spain and France had enough teams to pretty much fill their own Grand Tours with their own kind of first and second division teams.
And they had their own patrons that would stop the race when we were going up a climb and said, we're not racing here, which were like Bramati, Lombardi, these guys, Shirea. And it, you know, they kind of commanded the race. And if you sort of, like nowadays, everyone feels they've got a chance attacked, you know, they would basically kind of ostracize you from the rest of the race.
To bring it back to today, an Italian flavour to the breakaway. Sonny Cabrelli, Matteo Trentin, Giacomo Nizzolo, Michael Matthews, along with Nathan van Hooijdonk pulling for Wout van Aert. Matt, this is how you call it for us on Eurosport.
Who's going to open up the afterburners first? Van Hooijdonk takes it into the right-hand side. It is. It's been opened up here. Good opening up here by the rider from Groupama FDJ. And now going through the centre is Wout van Aert. Wout van Aert with an amazing turn of speed. Van Aert straight as an arrow down the centre. Van Aert looks as if he's going to take the win. Wout van Aert takes the win for Jumbo-Visma, a perfectly executed sprint.
Wout van Aert taking the win today, another spectacular show from him. I mean, he's had a remarkably consistent season already. Yeah. He's shown a
few ups and downs, actually. A
few ups and downs. And
I mean, it was only the other week we were talking about, you know, him basically chasing Van der Poel, wasn't it? And now he's sort of 1-0 to van Aert, if you like, in the classics, isn't it?
Well, and we saw him dropped in the week as well.
Yeah.
At the 3 days.
Which shows good character, really, doesn't it? I mean, you know, to be dropped, to still have the confidence. But, you know, he missed out last year, didn't he? But it's good for him to come back this year, show that last year, you know, with the adjusted calendar last year, that he's very much a rider of the ages now, and he's got his first big sort of, I know he won San Remo and that, but up there in Belgium, you know, of course, second in Flanders last year, and you know, first one on the board for him of the big three we spoke about last week.
So Nizzolo second, Matteo Trentin in third. Matt, you were calling it for us today. What were your big takeaways from the race?
My big takeaways were dropping into comms and seeing a 25-man group with only one De Koenig Quickstep rider in it. That's my big takeaway from the early stages. It's like, I'm trying to pick the bones out of what happened there. Citroën, AG2R Citroën had missed it as well. Alpecin Fenix had missed it. So the three big teams that had missed it. But good old Sam Bennett was the lone rider in blue, which is, I mean, when you look at the classics over the last few years, I mean, De Koenig Quickstep, as we know, have won a massive amount. But even when they don't necessarily win, they've got somebody in the top three.
Efforts, though?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I mean, me and Adam Blythe discussed it on air, trying to think about how the hell could De Koenig Quickstep miss such a big split. I mean, normally they'd have probably got at least two, maybe three, four, five riders in a move of that size. So it was quite unusual. So Sam Bennett obviously didn't have to ride, and Ballerini, Stibar tried to get across on a couple of occasions, but they didn't make it. And ultimately, well, that leads us to the bit about Sam. He was sick, wasn't he? Because he held on for grim death over the last ascent of the Kemmelberg, and then was sick a couple of Ks later. We don't know why. We haven't got the kind of debrief there, which is a big, big shame. But again, that aside, I think it's just showing us a different dimension to Sam Bennett. I mean, the spirit of Sean Kelly is alive, isn't it? And Carrick Consuer embodied in Sam Bennett. Great to see him at the front end of such a tough race.
I love the way he rides himself to a standstill, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, he was just rolling. Yeah,
he just he'll ride till the end. There's no airs and graces about him.
Yeah. We saw today, you know, so 33 kilometers to go it was, and we saw him vomit on the bike. And then he hung on for a further, well, he hung on until 14 kilometers to go when he was eventually dropped. I mean, and that shows some real steel.
Yeah. You know, for a green jersey winning the tour, he's the fastest man in the world at the moment, fair to say. You know, you give it his all. You can't take, yeah. And, you know, talking about Cipollini all those years ago, you know, Cipollini would never do that, would he? It was no, you know, he wouldn't see Cipollini being sick. He would give up before then because it was more about aesthetically how he looked, you know. But Sam, you know, someone who's in a similar position to him now, he's not self-conscious in terms of, you know, wanting his ego to be intact all the time. And it's, you can't really say much more than that when the guy rides himself to a standstill and being sick is... There's nothing much more you can do, is there?
Yeah, I mean, he looked absolutely cooked coming in, those final 10 kilometres particularly. But
To see Van Hooijdonk up there.
Yeah.
You know, of course, his dad won Flanders, didn't he, twice?
Yeah. Eddie Bosberg is his nickname, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The arguably the inventor of the over-the-knee warmer as well. Back in 1987 when he won Flanders, he cut off a pair of leg warmers. Because back then, in the 80s, you either had leg warmers or shorts, nothing in between. So... Edward Van Hooijdonk was a very tall rider. Had a kind of specially commissioned Colnago bike with a big massive top tube on it. Yeah,
they dropped the top tube.
He was, what is it?
You know who the first rider was to have that?
Who's that?
It was Froiler.
Oh, right.
It's called the Froiler, isn't it? The Froiler extensions.
Oh, right. There we go. The mustachioed Froiler. I've just lost my thread because I talked about over the knee warmers.
So I was going to say, I would assume the conversation there between Nathan Van Hooijdonk and Wout Van Aert is that... This guy's the best sprinter in the world at the moment. There is no way we want him there at the finish. I don't care what condition he's in. We don't want him hanging around at the finish.
Yeah,
we need to get rid of him now.
I think what we've seen with some of the best sprinters in the world, and that group, as you've described, was a sensational front group. I mean, we call it the Sprinters Classic.
Stephen Kung was the rider I missed out, actually.
Yeah, he's the only kind of rogue rider who had to try and go clear, and he ended up opening up the sprint. He attacked once on the run-in, so did Van Hooijdonk. He did a little bit of what I like to call a stealth manoeuvre when Wout van Aert just let his wheel go, just to test the others. But... Okay, it wasn't, I mean, the race was split up over many, many minutes. There's several, eight, nine groups all over the road. So not a classic sprinter's finish, but a group with some of the best sprinters in the world there. And many of whom were really, really fatigued because it had been attritional since 50Ks. So they're coming into the final. Normally those guys are kind of used to being delivered in an armchair for a bunch sprint. Completely different set of circumstances, but Van Hooijdonk, to pick up back on young Van Hooijdonk, did really, really well. Made sure for the last few Ks there weren't going to be any attacks. And Van Aert just, you know, was so strong in that sprint, wasn't he?
We didn't see many attacks.
It's people going out the back.
Because it was so strong that it was too strong to see anyone attacking off the front almost.
Yeah.
I spoke to Adam about that, and it was almost like a sort of world championships kind of ride. I mean, as you're really right, because a lot of the classics are a combination of the field whittling down, but also attacks off the front, splintering and reforming. But this one was just one group that just got smaller and smaller and smaller, basically, which was quite unusual. So, yeah, we didn't see a lot of attacks, but it's super attritional. The rider's going backwards. I mean, over that really concentrated, all those bergs. You know, you got 11 climbs within 63 kilometres, the last of which, of course, was the Kemmel with, you know, 35 Ks to go. But I still think it was a really, really good race, but in a quite an unusual way.
As I say, I ended up feeling a little bit sorry for Sam Bennett at the end there, but that can happen to you if you go that deep. Brad, you when we were chatting earlier, you said it's never happened to you, but is it a reasonably common thing for bike riders when they've put in a serious effort like that?
You know, and it only takes sort of a gel at the wrong time, or I mean, it can happen. Yeah, I mean, it's even though it didn't happen to me, it's not to say that I wasn't capable of having that. You know, lots of riders, it happens a lot on the track. You know, extreme efforts and things like that. But you know, and if you are capable of going that deep, you know, you can end up being sick. I mean, I think the only time I ever sort of really probably was at Verbier in the Tour de France in 2009 because I went that deep, but that was at altitude. I mean, have you ever had it, Matt?
I've had it when I've been doing. I've never had it in a race where I've been thrown up through physical effort, but I've had it when I've been doing very hard intervals, like on the home trainer. That's kind of quite common, and track riders doing maximal kind of either a sprint effort or an effort that puts you well into oxygen debt. And something, there's a physiological reaction to do with your spleen, which causes you to like throw up, basically. And there's a few, right, and it does take a lot to push yourself to that point because you're basically pushing yourself beyond what your body is really capable of. And that's the difference between, you know, success and failure quite often. But it's very rare we see it happen. That's if it was that, because we need to kind of caveat this with the fact this was a few Ks after the effort that he had to make. So we're not too sure yet. But I think we're all in agreement that he absolutely rode himself into the ground and completely, he couldn't do any more, could he? He was alone
today,
and that's it.
Bennett.
Yeah.
Two riders that we might have expected to see up there, given their form this year, who had to miss today's race entirely, Mads Pedersen and Milan Sanremo winner Jasper Stuyven, missed Gent-Wevelgem. Having tested positive for COVID-19.
Bloody hell. So it's still about, still lurking, isn't it?
So just a little warning there that...
The threat is real.
I get the feeling that it's not the last time that we will likely see that this season.
No, and I mean, it just shows you, doesn't it? We sort of sat here thinking it's sort of just past us. You know, it's over a year ago, wasn't it, when we sat here, when it first started, wasn't it?
We're in an unusual situation where we're sat here in Chiswick in the UK where things are actually looking relatively hopeful, but... In mainland Europe, it's that France is in lockdown. Paris-Roubaix, at the time of recording this, is still under threat.
Is it under threat still? Yeah.
And also,
it's been postponed, isn't it, Paris-Roubaix, until October?
Oh, is that right? Is that literally that must have happened today then? Because apparently they still haven't decided yet. ASO have not made a call on it yet. Yeah.
As I understood it, the chat in the week was most likely looking.
So it just shows, doesn't it? We almost start taking it for granted.
Well, Bora didn't start either. So Bora had an incident last night. I mean, Ralf Denk went on record to say he wasn't very happy with the decision that was made by one of the doctors. He said it was an arbitrary decision, but a member, because Matt Walls, young Matt Walls, a sprinter, neo-pro, contracted coronavirus about a week ago. And because of some of the team members that were at Gent-Wevelgem had been near him or something like that, they decided the team can't race. And that means they can't actually ride Douard d'Or's Vlaanderen in the week as well, which is the last cobbled race before Flanders. So Bora, another team. But I do agree, I think... I'm glad we can still race, but I think, you know, there's still going to be instances of teams not being able to start. I don't think this is the last, to be perfectly honest with you, sadly.
Better news for Bora over at the Tour of Catalunya, particularly from stage six this past week. Peter Sagan had his first bunch sprint win since the 2019 Tour.
Yeah, but he looked good in Sanremo, didn't he? You know, had it been a sort of 10, 15 metres... further the line.
We were pleasantly surprised to see him up there.
Yeah. And it just shows we can't underestimate him. Is he a threat now for Flanders?
I reckon he is, mate. Do you know, I think people are kind of, sort of almost have the stars kind of aligned. I mean, quite often when riders get sick or ill, people say, oh, it happens for a reason. I'm not saying him getting COVID-19 happened for a reason, but what it's actually done is delayed his start to the season. He rode, got round Tirreno, got a kick in Tirreno, great week in his legs. Normally he'd ridden these cobble classics, but because he was in isolation at altitude, couldn't ride as much, he opted to ride Catalunya, got some good miles in. And as Brad said, that little glimpse of form, because he was invisible in Milan-San Remo, gets fourth, wins that sprint in Catalunya I think he could be very, very dangerous indeed. So it's an unorthodox route to Flanders, but at the moment for Peter Sagan, it's looking pretty good. And I think you'll see him when L'Equipe and Het Nieuwsblad give him the kind of stars for Flanders. I think he'll be up there maybe three, maybe four, because but it's also good to see, because he's such an important rider in our sport. Yeah, yeah. And to see him get that win, I watched it unfold yesterday, and I was really chuffed for him. Really, really chuffed, because he's not just a great rider, I think he's an important rider as well.
Can that put a bit of fire in your belly, Brad, when you're taking a kicking like we saw Sagan take in Tirreno?
Yeah, I think for someone like him, you know, I think we became so accustomed over the last few years that he was sort of invincible, if you like, and was capable of doing anything. But I think last year, not being himself at the Tour, although he showed glimpses of it, we put it down to, you know, being a sort of a strange year with the Tour being late, and Peter's the kind of rider who probably needs a lot of racing to get to where he is. But then he did the Giro, and that stage of the Giro where he won was certainly the old Peter Sagan.
It was magnificent, wasn't it?
And he's carried on that, you know, and, you know, you're only as good as your last race in cycling, is a famous saying. And obviously at Tirreno, we sort of, you know, wondered whether he'd be back into, you know, to form enough for the classics. But we did talk about, you know, we talked about the kit last week. Mm. And I was saying he part of his obscurity as well now is because he doesn't stand out, because he became so synonymous with wearing the World Champs kit over 3 years. And you stick out like a sore thumb.
Or the Slovakian Champions kit. It's one of the two, well, isn't it?
Well, he came out remarkably similar.
Yeah. Whereas now he just sort of blends into the rest of the peloton. And I think that's helped him a little bit as well. And kind of that he's lost that invincibility a little bit, maybe in people's eyes. It's not that he's got a point to prove. It's that he's kept plugging away, you know. And I think he's had quite a few problems in his personal life and that, which obviously, you know, will affect anybody. And I think he's got some stability now and some structure back in his life. And he's getting back to cycling being his priority now. Yeah.
We saw Thomas de Gendt take a breakaway win at the Volta Catalunya today. Elsewhere in the race, Ineos, I mean, Brad, you called this last week.
Yeah.
They went in, they meant business. They sent, I mean, arguably the strongest team they possibly could. They've ended up on GC with the 1-2-3. Adam Yates clinching the biggest stage race win of his career. Richie Porte second, and Geraint Thomas in third. Domination, the perfect week.
Yeah.
For them,
I mean, they made a statement with the team they selected. You know, I said that G needed a performance probably for himself, and but not a winning performance, but a performance where he shows the type of teammate he could be, the super domestique. And he showed that, you know, it wasn't about winning for G, it was about the Tour de France. And that shows that, you know, we saw him at Tirreno ducking and diving, but they'd obviously been at altitude before Tirreno, and that always has an effect, you know, in that first race. But he looked every bit the G, even without winning, that he did a few years ago, winning that Tour. And I think he's a real threat this year. Adam has now, it's fair to say, come of age within that team. That's the last. It feels like with Adam that, you know, he was always a man who was seconds, thirds, fourths, fifth. He's always very, very consistent. But he's now kind of come of age, if you like his brother did a few years ago. And that probably the icing on the cake was going to Ineos, really. That's given that extra.
It's done something, isn't it, for Adam Yates? I mean, he's clearly
settled. It's the perfect team for him, isn't
it?
Yeah,
he's settled in really, really well. And I think when you look at the objectives of the squad, the ability for like guys like Thomas to kind of ride a good race out or near the head of affairs, but not worry about necessarily winning, but have a really good hard workout, and in the process of helping your teammate to win, end up with a podium. For the morale of the team, for the morale of G, is going to be wonderful. And then for Adam as well, because Adam isn't going to be, as far as I understand, is focusing on the Vuelta later in the year, isn't he, as well? So he can now turn on to kind of looking to ride for everybody else. He's got that big win, that big World Tour 1 week stage race, as you said, the biggest week-long stage race of his career, without a shadow of a doubt.
That team really suits certain riders. I mean, aside from Richie's Tour de France last year, he looks like every bit the rider now, who's going to be such a big, you know, asset to that team come July.
Can we say he stepped out of his brother's shadow, Adam Yates?
Yeah, and he probably had to leave the team to do that. Mm. I know that they work very well together. It's not a competition between them. But I just think that system will suit Adam down to the ground way more than Bike Exchange. And that's not to say that team didn't suit him, but it's sometimes a change is good. And you go to Ineos and with the strength of riders around him. I mean, the objective was clear this week. It was to win the race, and an incredible performance, really.
We're talking about him in terms of okay, he can now do a job for the other riders around him. Has he not put himself in the frame for a leadership role? I mean, we're assuming at this point he's going to do the Vuelta as their leader. But could his performances thus far this season, so strong in the UAE, only outgunned by Pogacar, taking on and sort of leaving Sepp Kuss, Alejandro Valverde in his wake this week, winning stage three, proper statement stuff from Adam Yates. Can we talk about him in terms of leading Ineos at the Tour now?
Not this year, because I think it will, unless there's something extreme happens to Geraint, that performance from Geraint is cemented more than anything his leadership for the Tour, because he was, you know, in some terms of sort of sharing out the spoils, he's done that for Adam, and you know, everything's on track. Adam, I always said, even last year when we announced the signing of him, that is, this ain't about him coming in and taking leadership. It's clear this year, Bernal for the Giro, as we understand, G for the Tour, and then Adam is the next one on the list after that. No, the departure of Froome, Geraint, you'd think maybe coming towards the end of his career, but again, never underestimate him. Adam is the next one now, the next British star that they will look to win the Tour in the next 2, 3, 4 years. These are like the early stages, if you like.
There's not the sense that, okay, Teo's had he's had a bang. His season hasn't started quite as well as we hope he might have done. Do we sub out Adam Yates for Teo at the Tour?
I think Teo can go to the Tour, assuming he gets, you know, he corrects this injury and gets some racing in his legs, because the poor lad's only had 3 days racing so far this year, up to now, isn't he? Which is a big shame. So we don't know what's going on behind the scenes in terms of reconfiguring Teo's season. But for Teo to go to the Tour, had he had a normal kind of run into it, it's just an important part of his career. Having won the Giro, the next step is to go to the Tour without any pressure, because you've got two leaders for the Tour. You've got Carapaz and Geraint, and then you've got Bernal, as Brad just said, for the Giro d'Italia, and then Adam. So kind of Teo's got this kind of role. Okay, it's just almost like, it's kind of a very old-fashioned term, but I think Teo needs to be blooded, as it were, in the Tour de France. That's really important. But because of the smaller teams now, and if Teo's not quite right, Ineos will pull him out. They'll pull him from the Tour he might not even be ready for the Giro. It could be a Vuelta situation, and Adam comes back in for the Tour. Who knows?
I think he's bottom of that list of leaders, even though he's won a Grand Tour.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I think Teo probably accepts that. You know, he'd be the first to accept that out of his modesty.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's the Tour of the Basque Country next for Teo. Matt, you've just mentioned Carapaz and Adam Yates. They'll face off against Pogacar, Roglic, a real sort of all-star cast again. Hugh Carthy quietly went well this week, actually.
Top ceremony.
Yeah. In Catalunya. I mean, Chavez, Enrique Mas, not quite where he hoped. Or he might hope he would be at this point. Jakob Fuglsang, Valverde, Mollema, Michael Woods. They'll all be there while Thomas is off to do a training camp in Tenerife.
Yeah.
So, I mean, back Brad, talk us through that. Rather than now, you know, building again and going to another race, Thomas is taking, he's almost taking a step back, G.
Well, because he's shown where he's at. And there's a long time to the Tour. And he accumulates that type of form to be able to race like that off the back of, obviously, his altitude camp before Tirreno, then Tirreno, racing hard, let it soak up the work they do. Because they do a lot of work up in altitude. The altitude itself gives you kind of another few percent. And it's as I said, we were talking about the other week, we were talking about kind of the way Van Aert, Van der Poel and that were racing in Tirreno. And that G and that were probably lacking a little bit, because their training is much more based around becoming very efficient at threshold all day and efficient at kind of burning fuel, and that which is much more conducive to the Grand Tours, where you're racing over 3 weeks and it's a war of attrition. And that's what they're building to. Whereas Van der Poel and those guys, you know, Van der Poel's coming off of a world cyclocross world title, and they're kind of really kind of, you know, big numbers hitting ups and downs, lefts and rights. But Van der Poel's, you know, is a classics man, and that's what his goals are. Whereas G, you know, he's very clear with G. He's the Tour de France again, a second Tour under his belt. And you can't chase everything. And as I say, there is risks with racing, the crashes. We saw Primoz at Paris-Nice. We saw, of course, Teo's misfortune this year. And it's just safe. You know, I think he was lacking racing last year coming to the Tour G, wasn't he? And form. And I think he's where he wants to be. So why push it? Why risk? Just go back, train in a you know, kind of a secure environment where he doesn't have the distractions of home life with children, etc. It's just you concentrate on one thing up there. It's just, you know, eat, sleep, and train, and, you know, make the most of the altitude training, and then come back and put that into practice in the next race. But as Primoz and those guys, he's recovered from a crash. And this is his next thing. Now, Basque Country is cold. It tends to rain a lot.
Can be very, very cold up here.
Yeah, but I think G's where he wants to be. And let's not forget, this is about the bigger picture for G.
It's 22 days racing he's had. I've just totted it up so far. And when you compare that to Teo's 3. So there's a lot of good miles in the bank, especially when you factor in, you know, Catalunya is a brutally hard race. Terreno is incredibly hard. So it's not just the accumulated days. It's the density and of the intensity, basically. So Brad's right. He just needs to take this where he needs to be.
Yeah.
And now he's come out of it uninjured, safe. Yeah. It's like, okay, let's get in this kind of vacuum of keeping that just simmering.
Yeah. You just keep topping the glass up and not burning that in the mental energy as well of going race to race. Because G's a racer. And when G wants to turn himself, he's a bit like Sam Bennett. He can go deep G. You know, we saw him at the Giro last year, crash, things like that. And it's going back to that Armstrong kind of, who started that, you know, racing little, and that mindset which we adopted in 2012, which was, you know, train hard, race easy, you know, and we tended to train harder numbers wise. You can control the numbers and your workloads and things like that, and back off. Whereas race days, you know, you have to get up the next morning and race, and you can probably overdo it a bit, racing too much. Whereas, so you compare this to last year where we saw him at the Dauphiné, was lacking form, and he was chasing form, and they eventually pulled him and put him in the Giro. He's now in, you know, March with July looming. He can now tweak and manipulate the training program to stay and gain a few more percent. He's almost there. You know, he's better shape now than he was going to the Tour
last
year.
He looked good, didn't he? He really did look good. He looked, actually never really looked super, super stretched, did he? I mean,
looked like the Ineos train of old.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it's funny that they've come in for some heavy fire, haven't they? Oh, it's just the sky of old. It's like, well, hold on a minute. Let's just go back a few.
I think it'll be the dominant at all.
Let's have a little look at how Adam actually won that first stage and got himself in the jersey. He attacked 5K out. You know, it was a real kind of, it was off the back of a bit of a train, but he attacked and then dropped several riders in the process. The move to win the race, you're not then going to race aggressively to kind of defend it. You've got three riders up there. You know, what more do you do? You have to lead the race. Any team in that position would have had to ridden the same way. And I'm kind of not necessarily defending the team. I just think it's important that people understand how races kind of pan out. You race aggressively, Erzi, you seize control. You know, and stage racing is very different than one day racing, you know. And I think they've actually raced quite a great. I think it's been a different sort of team. But once they get into a jersey, it will be doing what they do best. Let's be honest,
Brad. Just to tie off Catalunya, Chris Froome, we saw him losing almost on the first climb, the first sort of serious time the race went uphill. We saw him lose 8.5 minutes on stage one, still working his way back.
Yeah. Is it going to be enough for the Tour? You know, have we seen enough of? I thought the Vuelta last year was a real good sort of step up the ladder in terms of getting back to the old Chris Froome. I thought he might have been a little bit further ahead of where he's at. You know, certainly a top 10 performance around that Hugh Carthy sort of region. I wouldn't say a fear for him, but probably with every week that goes by and every race that goes by, it's becoming less likely that we're going to see a Chris Froome at this year's Tour de France that's capable of winning in the old manner. And it must be a strange feeling for him as well, being on the receiving end of a, perhaps an even stronger unit of Ineos than when he was there.
Yeah, I think you could argue, they are looking remarkably strong at the moment, Ineos. And I think again, Chris Froome has come in for a lot, you know, quite a lot of vitriol, quite a lot of flack. I mean, it's just like, step back from this a minute. 2019, nearly died.
Yeah, I can't understand.
And it really, and, you know, I think whatever your kind of views on Chris Froome, there was an athlete doing what he does for a living, hit a wall at 60K an hour, broke multiple bones in his body and is now back riding at professional level. I just think it's going to take time. But, you know, he is one of the most highest paid riders in the world. And at some point, let's be honest, business is business. Israel Startup Nation are going to want to see a little bit of return on the Chris Froome investment. So there's a bit of pressure there, but still,
but you know, he needs it. He's earned it.
Yeah, but he just, I just think he needs more time. But to answer that question, I think it's going to be tough for him to be competitive at the Tour de France. I really, really do.
But I do think he warrants a bit more respect from the criticism.
He does.
You know, let's just give him a break. You know, he's like you say, he's come back from something. You know, if anything, you should celebrate. It's good to see him in the peloton.
I agree.
He is.
Is there a sense that he's already provided ISN with the return on their investment, given the amount that we talk about him still and the amount that we talk about Israel Startup Nation?
He's warranted that because of his Palmares.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's paid. You know, I don't think he should feel bad that he's paid that much and not performing at the level of... He is Chris Froome at the end of the day. And again, he's another one you can never underestimate, you know. He could turn that round on a day.
Yeah, and I think also as well that the when he signed his contract was post that crash. I mean, when they signed him, they knew they were signing Chris Froome, the chap that's won 4 Tour de France's, 2 Vueltas, and a Giro. That's in the bank. You've now got, but there's nothing guaranteed about the future. You know, it's not as if they signed him and then he had a crash. It's like, oh no, they signed him off the back of that injury. So there's always going to be a little bit of a gamble there. But they've got, you know, one of the most, you know, talented riders of his generation within the team that can give the, you know, that can help the team as well in terms of just looking after the younger riders. You've got that wealth of experience for 3 years on board, and that's worth its kind of weight in gold as well.
And we're always going to notice when someone like him loses 8 minutes. You know, we don't talk about the other people that are around him that also lost 8 minutes. You know, it's, I mean, you know, we very rarely talk about Romain Bardet. I know he's not on the same level as Chris Froome, but he's changed teams. He's looking to bounce back into a podium place in the Tour. I mean, where's he been this year? You know, where's his return?
I'll put Pino in that same boat as well.
For his investment at that team, you know.
Brad, Matt, a couple of other races to cover off this week. The E3 Saxo Bank Classic. The only race, as far as I'm aware, named after a motorway. We saw Casper Asgreen take the victory on the line, having broken off the front of the breakaway, be caught by the breakaway, and then break again. De Koenig Quickstep with 1 and 2 on the podium in the end. Florian Senechal coming in second. Mathieu van der Poel to round out the top three, which leads me to the wider question. How do you beat Mathieu van der Poel? And Wout van Aert, for that matter. Brad, this would appear to be how. You do it with
numbers.
Playing the numbers, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the one thing they probably lack. Jumbo in certain races around, you know, van Aert. And Van der Poel certainly lacks numbers around him. But and that, you know, he's built the reputation as someone who is capable of doing it on his own, which we've seen the last year or two. But it will go against him at times. Obviously, he's highly paid by Canyon. He's a big asset to them, isn't he? And the cross is obviously a big part of that. The manufacturers, you know, riders tend to become just synonymous with a bike manufacturer now, and tend to go where, because they're highly paid. You know, a lot of the teams are funded by bike manufacturers because of a certain rider, and Van der Poel is one of them. And at what point will he change teams? Because that might be something that... they will pay more and more to stay with whichever team they're with. And will that jeopardize, hinder his career, do you think, Matt, in terms of winning races? I mean, you put him in a De Koenig Quickstep where he wouldn't probably be as highly paid as he is there. He wouldn't have the brand building that Canyon are doing behind him, but he would probably win more races, wouldn't he?
We kind of morphed into a different conversation, but I think it's a very, very interesting one, the Mathieu van der Poel one. And it's just, I mean, even his father, Adrie van der Poel, himself an iconic, legendary, talented bike rider, is left scratching his head at the way Mathieu conducts himself in races tactically. And when I mean that, I mean it's for the commentators, for the fans of the sport, it's spectacular. Oh no, that's what I'm just getting to that. I love it. But in terms of actually racing to a plan, I don't think at the moment, or maybe next year, van der Poel would fit in a team like Ineos or like Jumbo Visma, or because he is a showman. I mean, and the sport is all the better for it. But if he wants to start to gather monuments and put them on his shelf in a few years' time and a world championships, all that he wants to win it. Like, he's one of a handful of riders, including Van Aert, that could win every monument, including Lombardy, races like that, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, because he can climb as well as sprint. And I think because of the way he rides beautifully, he rides from almost like a different era, but it's slightly incompatible with racing in the modern era when you've got numbers. And it's great at the moment, but if he wants to, yeah, get that trophy cabinet full, he might have to go to a team that's slightly more conservative, slightly more tactically shrewd, and De Koenig, but he'd have to do it their way, not his way.
Do you think
you don't want to stifle a rider too much, because it's, you know, the rider has to be able to kind of function, make decisions out on the road. But when they're ones that are like, oh my God, what was all that about? He doesn't fit in any other team apart from Alps and Phoenix, which are basically built around him at the moment, aren't they?
I wouldn't say, do you think he did too much? Do you think he showed too much in Tirreno? Which has gone against.
Do you mean in terms of in Tirreno Adriatico? Do you mean
the way he showed there? Not in terms of physically doing too much, but do you think he showed too much to his rivals?
I think he's one of the most feared riders out there at the moment. I mean,
think that performance probably went against him. That's what we spoke about, wasn't it? Who could beat him?
To me, this week, De Koenig have shown. So we asked the question: how do you beat that double act of Van Aert and Van der Poel? De Koenig have shown to me that so far this season, certainly, and probably most of last season, they're too tempted too often to put all of their eggs in the Alaphilippe basket. Whereas it doesn't just come down to Alaphilippe, Van Aert and Van der Poel. Actually, you can take them out of the equation entirely if you just play the numbers. And then so this week at E3 Harelbeke, they've ended up with a 1-2 because they didn't just rely... Well, I mean, Alaphilippe wasn't in the race, but they didn't just rely on that tactic of everything behind Alaphilippe. And then we see Lulu face off against the other big two.
I think there's certain races with a certain parkour that are going to suit Julian Alaphilippe more than a lot of teammates. But when it comes to the Cobble Classics, you know, and when you look at the lineup, go back to E3 for a minute, you look at their lineup, Stibar, Lampaert, Tim de Klerk, the only domestique really, Ballerini, Seneschal, and Bert van Leurberger as well, then Asgreen. You've got, from their seven riders, five of those, if you saw with the winner, yeah. No other team comes anywhere near the depth of winning talent, but they're all equal. They're pretty much, there might be one rider who's kind of a little bit better, but they've got so many options. And most teams have one or two at best, maybe three. Some teams have two. Other teams don't really have anybody that is capable of winning.
Why do they so often seem to only back Alaphilippe?
I don't know if that's necessarily true. You know, I think in certain races they do. And I think what he's willing to do by his very nature, especially if we look back to the opening weekend when he was on the offensive quite a lot, I mean, him attacking up the road, he was doing essentially what Asgreen did, which is just take the pressure off. You know, it's like, this is a great entertainment and we can just sit back. So why not use Alaphilippe? I don't think they're necessarily riding for Alaphilippe because they went and won with Ballerini in opening weekend, didn't they, anyway? But he's the only rider, I think, in the whole of the De Koenig Quickstep lineup that is a little bit of a kind of, you know, is a little bit kind of loose and a little bit flamboyant, rides on instinct a lot, maybe not quite as unruly, for want of a better word, as Mathieu van der Poel. But there'll be certain races like Liège, for example, and Flesch, he'll be pretty much the sole leader. But for all the other races, they've got five riders that can win them and no other team comes anywhere near, because that's the way the team is permed. That's the way they sign riders that are capable of winning and everybody's given a chance. And they're the only team that's built like that. And that's why they are not unbeatable, but that's why they're a difficult proposition. Even when you've got the best rider pound for pound in the world, when you're up against five, you can't do it.
No.
Elsewhere this week, Cav showing some form at Coppi-e-Bartali, leading a stage race for the first time in 4 years. You'd imagine few will mean more to him, Brad, but it's still crossing the line first, not necessarily just taking the GC jersey.
It's a step in the right direction, doesn't it? Cav works as hard as anyone, and it's great for him. You know, it doesn't matter how, you know, whether it's considered small or, you know, comparable to what he has done in the past. It's Mark Cavendish up there, yep, not first, but shows he's on the way. But to pull on a leader's jersey, which I think is great for him, really. And it's a darn sight better than watching him and Klein on the lineup for Weatherham last year.
It's the first time I've seen him out of the saddle sprinting.
It's just good. He looks happy again
as well.
And he is happy.
I mean, that's the key word there, is happy,
and
isn't it?
Cav deserves to be happy in a team where he can now, you know, if we keep talking about, you know, his retirement and stuff, you can start thinking about that now. But you know, whether he's winning or not, his presence, and just to see him up there and see him, and the fact we're talking about him in the leaders' jersey and not talking about him getting dropped or not finishing, or you know, has he got a team next year, or seeing emotion in his face that we saw last year when he crossed the line again, Wevel game, is just it's brilliant.
Yeah, I just echo what Brad's saying. You know, to see him in that jersey was to a lot of us who know him quite well, was actually quite emotional. And to see him narrowly missing out on victory was good. You know, okay, he knows it's not quite the same standard as a World Tour race, but it's just wonderful. But it's his, you know, I sent him a little message afterwards and he messaged back a little voice memo. And the joy in his voice was something quite powerful. And I think he's happy. He's been given this place at De Koenig, a place that he spent many years, some of his biggest successes in his pro career were there. And he's also, I think what he's clearly enjoying as well is passing on that experience to the younger riders. And I think he feels like the elder statesman now in the team. And a lot of his kind of social media stuff over the week of Settimana Internazionale, the race he did, was saying, great to be part of this young Wolfpack team, you know, leading, like they won the final stage, didn't they? And he was, I think he likes not having the pressure of being Mark Cavendish, but just being able to ride his bike and race and be part of a team. And once, I think a lot of the pressure has now gone away because he's got what he wanted, another year racing with, you know, racing at this kind of level, and he's having fun. And definitely not seeing the last of him, but I think we'll all agree that, especially Brad's point, he's happy, he's smiling, he's in a good place. And whatever happens in the future, I think his path to that end point is a kind of good one. He's on the right kind of path that he needs to be now.
At the other end of the, well, at the other end of the age spectrum, Ethan Hayter for Ineos, he took the win at Coppi e Bartali on stage three. Incredibly consistent week for him, Brad.
Yeah.
Fifth, first, fourth, fourth.
Yeah.
Superb.
I mean, it's get another young talent. You know, we spoke about a few over sort of Kerner, Brussels Kerner, and, you know, the amount of Brits we've, I mean, we spoke about this year already. Quite a contrast to what we talked about earlier, about 20 years ago when we were sort of in those races. But in other circumstances, or 10 years ago, 15 years, he would have been one of our best riders in talking about those kind of results. But it's sort of an aftermention, afterthought, you know, with everything else we had to get through with Adam Yates and G and the like. So, again, another one for the future, isn't it? Fantastic it's kind of educational sort of, you know, process he's going through in a squad that's, you know, was it probably their C squad they put out for that race, wasn't it? And it's just brilliant, the wealth of talent we've got in this country now. We're one of the leading nations now in terms of cycling.
And I think that persistence, I can't believe he didn't win the points classification. He's only second in the points. That's a bit unfair, isn't it? But I mean, looking back to the start of the year as well, I mean, up there in the TT, individual time trial in the Toile de Bessage, third there as well against some really good opposition. So he can do it all. He's a great track rider. He's got a lot of potential, and the fact that he can do those sorts of rides, he can climb reasonably well as well. He can sprint, he can climb, he can time trial. You know, the future's bright for that lad, but they've got so much, as we said, there's a lot of young under 23 talent at World Tour level now that we've almost got this kind of wealth of riches, but definitely one to watch out for. That was a superb week by him, yeah.
Looking ahead then, the Oostende Flandre midweek, as Matt mentioned, Tour of Flanders to look forward to. Brad, we'll be back for that next weekend. Predictions time.
I would now start thinking about Alaphilippe. Outsiders, yeah, of course, aside from Van der Poel, Van Aert, I would like to think someone like Sagan, definitely, because I've put him in the picture now. And a long shot of Trentin.
Yeah. Mm. I've just got the start sheet up here, just having a little bit of a scroll through, but I've got a funny feeling about Peter Sagan, you know. He's just getting stronger and stronger. And when you look at the big three that, you know, the spotlight shone on them, you kind of, I also wonder how long, I mean, clearly Wout van Aert's in great form, Mathieu van der Poel is in form, but it's like, how long can they keep that burning so brightly, you know, when there's other riders a bit more experienced, a bit calmer maybe coming up. It's going to make for a mouth-watering race. The Ronde is one of the most exciting one-day races in the world, isn't it? I can't wait, but yeah, I'm going to go for, I've got a cheeky, sneaky feeling about Peter, Mr. Sagan, yeah, to double up, to be win number two, wouldn't it, if he were to pull off the victory.
That brings us to the end of this episode of The Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, brought to you by Zwift, where fun is fast. Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
As ever. And Matt, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Where can we follow you on social media?
At Real Stevens, because all the other Stevens were taken.
Brad, as ever.
So we go.
So we go. You can also follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK. Plus, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you also to our producer, Pete Burton. Podcast Pete. Finally, from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share your thoughts, and rate us. Brad, as we said, plenty of action to look forward to coming up on Eurosport and GCN Plus this week.
Yeah, good, the big one, Flanders.
In the meantime, have a good week.
Yeah.
We'll see you then.
Everyone.
Matt, thanks again.
Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.